Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to listen to. And everyone, by everyone I mean, yeah, anyone who cares, anyone who's interested, anyone who likes science fiction, anyone who wants to get into science fiction, all that kind of stuff. I've got some really great emails and comments recently from some people saying, hey, I've just started your podcast, I'm really enjoying it. Other people saying, yeah, it's really great that I've gone through all of the books that I've read so far and listened to your reviews of all the books, and now I'm going through and listening to all of them. And even a few people who have emailed or messaged me on goodreads.com or wherever it is and said, yeah, now we've managed to listen to every single episode, and the last episode was one of my favorites of yours. I think that was the Prestige one, and got some good comments about the episode that me and Juliana, my girlfriend, recorded about Dune, which was Frank Herbert's Dune, which we had a lot of fun doing. And so really what I'm just asking now is, please, if you are one of the people who have managed to listen to every single episode of the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast, if you are a 100%er, go and email me and tell me which is your favorite episode, or just, you know, how long it took you to get through all of the episodes. I listened to a few podcasts and I've got to 100% on a few podcasts, different podcasts, which isn't too difficult if you started listening near the beginning of when the podcast first started coming out. But I've been doing this since January of 2008, and now it's January 2013. So that's 5 years of doing this podcast. 177 main episodes plus a few extra episodes, 5.4 days of audio, and 3.55 gigabytes worth of 64-bit MP3 audio to get through. So yeah, if you have managed to listen to my voice for 5.4 days, not continuously, but you know, just over the last 5 years, five days of audio over 5 years, go and email me, because I'd be interested to see what your, like I say, what your favorite or least favorite thing is, and how I'm doing 5 years later. That's what I'm just saying. 5 years I've been doing this now, which is pretty cool. Anyway, so let's get on to today's book. Oh no, I just wanted to mention as well, yesterday me and Juliana, we watched Prometheus, and I was expecting a bad movie because I hadn't heard that many good things about it, mostly that the 3D was pretty fun and it looked pretty spectacular on IMAX. And that's pretty much all I knew about it. And so I went into it with low expectations, and I was pretty much blown away by how high my expectations were compared to the movie that I got. I'm not going to do any review of that, but the idea of Prometheus and all the stuff that Prometheus gets wrong, which is a real pity after all the stuff that Alien and Aliens got right, I thought it was a real pity. And if I did do a movie review podcast, which I'm not going to do because so many other people do that kind of thing, but I think Prometheus would be one of those movies which it would be so bad, it would be such a bad movie that would be the kind of movie to inspire me to do a movie review podcast. Just like I was really inspired to do this book review podcast when I read a book called The Swarm. I can't remember what it was. It was a German science fiction book translated into English, and it was so bad, and I wanted to tell everyone how bad I thought it, that I thought I need my own podcast to share my good reviews and negative reviews of this. Anyway, so let's get on to today's episode, a proper book review that I'm going to do. It's called Great North Road by Peter F. Hamilton. I've read a few of this guy's books. In fact, I've read all of his novel-length books. There's only one book of his that I've not read so far yet, and that is the Manhattan in Reverse, which is a collection of shorter stories and novellas. I've actually read quite a few of the stories in that. But otherwise, yeah, I might as well call myself a Peter F. Hamilton 100%er, because I have read all of his novels. And what Great North Road is for me is kind of like a best of. It's like the greatest hits of Peter F. Hamilton, because what he's done, he's kind of wrapped up all of his like good ideas, all of his best ideas, all of his best character ideas, and his, you know, conspiracy things and his action and the horror stuff and all the technology and all the cool stuff from his previous, well, not all of it, but all of the best stuff and all of the interesting stuff. He's decided to go, okay, if I was just going to write one book and put them all into one book, what would it be like? And it would be a bit like the Great North Road. which is 1,000 pages long. So it's a lot longer than his previous short series, like the Mindstar Rising. But it is, I think that's longer than his other previous big epic standalone novel called Fallen Dragon, which I think I reviewed on this podcast. And also, it's not quite as, it's nowhere near as big as his sort of like massive trilogies or 5-series books or these other ones. It's certainly got the scope of some of his larger series, getting on towards that kind of scope, even though there's, it doesn't go off into like godlike powers and, journeys to the center of the entire galaxy as what happens in the Void trilogy and these other ones. But there is a lot going on in this book. So while I will mention a lot of things that are contained in this book, I'm not obviously going to be mentioning all of them because, well, there's just too much. I've made quite a few notes, and I realized that by making notes, hopefully I'll be able to get through the notes more quickly than I could do if I didn't have notes, because then I might ramble on a lot. So there is, like I say, it touches on a lot of interesting things or a lot of ideas and lots of themes that Hamilton has gone over in his previous books. But there is quite a lot of new stuff as well, which I'll touch on as I go through. But the great thing about Peter F. Hamilton, and this is what someone mentioned to me after my previous review of his books. It's just like, yeah, I just get in there and I just read his books and I feel comfortable because I know they're going to be good. I know the characters are going to be good. I know that I'm probably going to be let down slightly by the endings of his book because, I don't like it. It's like, you just go, okay, which character is going to be given godlike powers and then Deus Ex Machina themselves out of all of the different characters out of the problem and things. So there is that kind of like, thing always hanging around at the end of his books, which slightly lets me down. But really, to get there, it's like comfort food. And someone said, for a lot of people, Peter F. Hamilton is their exciting, hard science fiction kind of stuff. It's not just vacation reading or beach reading or airport book kind of stuff. But that's what I consider this book to be. Now, this is a big chunky book. I listened to the audio book of it and it was 36 hours long. I think the book itself is over 1,000 pages. And Tamahome, who is you might know if you listen to the SFF audio podcast, he put some comments. He's commenting on it as he reads through on goodreads.com. In his review there, he's putting up his updates there. He's only, like page 70 of 948. Oh, yes, 948 pages. And he's going through. And then I said, oh, finished. And he thought I finished up really quickly. He says, oh, I need to become a professional juggler. So I've got lots of time on my hands. The reason why I finished this book up very quickly is because over New Year's, I was ill and I was crossing the Atlantic on a cruise ship. And I pretty much sat in my room and listened to this audiobook and went to sit in a hot tub and listened to the audiobook and sat out and watched the sea and watched the Atlantic Ocean, sailing past as we passed through it. And I just listened to this book. So I managed to get through it all in around about a week. So, let's just get onto it then. This book was released in September last year. But it came out, like I say, it came out on Audible. So I gave it a go that way. And it was 2 Audible credits as well. This is the first book, I think, that I've read which has cost 2 Audible credits. But for me, it's worth it. Like Peter F. Hamilton, I will just buy one of his books and read it. So, the first idea that we have in this world is of course a not far future. It's more of a near future world. It's set in 2142, and the next idea that we have from Peter F. Hamilton's previous ones is that you have gates that have been opened into other worlds, which are a bit like the gates of the Pandora's Star, those kind of gateways that go around. They would have like railway lines going in that one. This one, it's not railway lines because the gates aren't quite as prolific, or they're not quite as many of them. Let me put it that way. They're a bit more difficult to control, but you can have gateways going from one world to the other. So once this technology was invented and refined, it takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of investment to be able to open one of these gates and explore another world and find another world which has got the right atmosphere to send humans through to, and it takes a lot of time to do that. But they do find the other atmospheres and the other planets with good atmospheres, but only kind of country level investment, like national groups, or like groups like the European Union or the United States, or bigger things like that. They open the gates into other worlds and expand out into the other world. And so if you're poor, you get sent through and you say, hey, go set up a farm if you've not got a job. Or if you're a criminal or a dissident, that's where people are sent through these gates to set up these to set up it in new planets. And of course, we've seen this a lot of times before in Peter F. Hamilton's books, like the frontier worlds and people going through and starting up new lives on different planets. The thing that happens, though, is because it takes so much investment, the whole economies of different nations are like diverted into this expansion and away from innovation and scientific progress. So even though this is taking place in 2142, technology really only progressed up until the point when these gates could be opened, and then technology like mostly kind of stagnates in a way. So so even though 2042 seems to be a long way away, it's quite familiar in a way, because all the cities which used to be growing and growing and growing, and the cities, like any cities around the world, would be the main growing you know, economic growth kind of drivers, suddenly they're not anymore. And the and the expansion happens in these off Earth worlds. So, except of course in the cities with gates, the cities who have gates there going through. So there's a gate in I know there's meant to be one somewhere in Germany, and there's one in Israel, and there's one in Miami, and there's one in California, and all these gates that go through into these other different planets. Those cities really benefit a lot from having a gate there. So the and also another thing is that there's a big alien threat too. There's these Xanth. They're called the Xanth, and I'm not quite sure what the Xanth are, but they're these big aliens which kind of come ripple out of space-time, and they don't so much invade as just like drop shit onto another planet, onto one of these captured planets. Oh no, not so captured. One of the new Earth planets or the new human planets, and they're kind of captured by the Xanth, which are this swarming kind of thing, which again, not really, it's never really explained what they are because it's very mysterious, but you get the Xanth swarms and the Xanth shards that rain down on other planets. So sometimes these other human planets have had to be, they've had to be evacuated. But yeah, so there is a family called the Norths, or there was a guy called North. That was his second name. I can't remember his first name. And he got his bollocks shot off in Afghanistan, and he can't have kids. So he decided, well, I'm going to have some clones. So he gets a clone. It doesn't work. He tries another clone. It doesn't work. And then he decides to, you know, get three clones, and these three clones worked. And one of them was called Bartram. No, what was it? Something A, something beginning with A, something beginning with B, Bartram, Andy, Bartram and Caleb, just say that or whatever. And so they were clones of this other guy. And when he died, these other guys kept control of the business, and they opened a gate into a planet called St. Libra. And the gate is in Gateshead, which is interesting. Even though most of the book is set in Newcastle, the gate itself is in a place called Gateshead. But it's never really mentioned that it's in Gateshead. It just said, oh, yes, it's south of the Tyne in a place where it's called this. Or maybe it does. Maybe it is called Gateshead. I can't remember. Anyway, Gateshead, which is a place now called Gateshead, a real place. So, yeah. And so Newcastle and the whole area becomes a big kind of, not so much a frontier town, but like a place where there's lots and lots of stuff happening. You know, there's lots of money flowing through there. The oil flows back from St. Libra. They have the biodiesel algae fields in St. Libra. And of course, when they bring back the oil back from these other planets, they're burning it on Earth. So they're not only putting lots of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide in the that already exists on Earth, or the carbon which has been sequestered in the coal and oil of Earth, and it's being put back into the atmosphere. Lots of carbon from other planets is also being put into the atmosphere of Earth. So global warming has again fucked up the planet, which is a much bigger theme in, say, the Mindstar Rising novels and the Misspent Youth novels of Peter Hamilton, because that's where he talks a lot more, because those are set like almost, I think, 100% on Earth, or at least they're not spreading out into lots of different planets in those novels. So because humanity is stuck on a single planet, any kind of ecological disasters is a lot more important in that way. And that's what you get now. So winter in Newcastle is like Siberia. And that's where the story begins. Winter in Newcastle, and it's absolutely freezing, and all of the buildings are having to be retrofit for the extra cold winters. Meanwhile, across in St. Libra, that's a paradise, you know, tropical jungle planet across there. Very, very exotic. And for the rest of the book, half of the action takes place in Newcastle, and half of the action takes place over on St. Libra. And St. Libra is really well realised, I think. It's this is another one of Peter F. Hamilton's strengths, is describing alien planets and the ecology and how it all fits together. There's no insects or animals on this on St. Libra. Only plants, and they're trying to work out why are there only plants. And you know, it's one of these mysteries, is like why was there no animals? Why did no animals evolve here at all? And it's very, very hot there. Like I say, it's the opposite of Newcastle in winter. And the chronology of the book is takes a few months, runs over a few months, so the winter in Newcastle turns to spring and gets warmer and warmer. Of course, it never gets as hot as it is in St. Libra, or does it? Well, we'll see by the end of the book. I don't want to give away too many spoilers about the weather in Newcastle and St. Libra. Anyway, so what do we have here? Yes, moving on to the story. So The North brothers, the North clones, A, B, and C North clones, they all have clones of themselves as well, because if they have sex with a woman, they instead of their genetic material being combined with that of the mother, they just purely, it's purely their own genes that get passed on. So it's another, like, exact clone of them. And then when the third level clones get, they pass on their genes, they, of course, there's a bit wrong with them. And then the fourth level clones, well, they're really wrong. And then fifth and sixth level clones, well, you know, you might as well not even do that. So of course, all the extra clones. So it's one of those, it's one of these weird things that all these clones walking around of each other, all of these North, these A, B, and C Norths, and the 1, 2, 3 level clones, North clones. And these, of course, run the business. They run the North's oil empire and gateway empire and all of the stuff that they want to do. And yet the different strands of the North family, the A Norths are interested in business, the B Norths are interested in longevity treatments. Again, that's another element which is Peter F. Hamilton, the rejuvenation elements which he has in Misspent Youth. That's what that's all about. Also in Pandora's Star and all of those other books and the Void trilogy. The characters are very, very long lived because of this this rejuvenation, a very, very expensive rejuvenation process. And in this book, it's around about the, you know, it's a little bit less experimental than it is in Misspent Youth, but it's getting there. So that's it. So that's what the B Norths are doing. And C Norths there, well, they're wanting to do their own thing, and they'll go and live around Jupiter, I think. So lots and lots of Norths. The one North is very, very rich and important. The two Norths, less so, but there's a lot of them. Three Norths, well, they're kind of like the runt of the litter. Not so many of them, because once they realise that they're not quite as good as the two Norths, they don't breed very much. Anyway, so what happens is a two North body is found in the Tyne underneath the Millennium Bridge in Newcastle, and they fish it out. And the main character, one of the main characters is Sid, and he is a policeman or a police detective. And they find the body, and you're like, ah, okay, well, who is this two North, and where did he come from, and why is he killed? And it turns out that he's killed by, of course, this happens in the very beginning of the book, he's killed by an alien, or he's suspected to have been killed by an alien. But they're going, well, where did this alien come from? Who is this alien? What's it going? Well, 20 years before this book begins, a murder took place in the North family, and lots of Norths were killed, and they were all killed by this five-fingered blade, like this Freddy Krueger hand blade kind of thing. And this murder was pinned on someone called Angela, and she was put in jail for it, even though she always said, it wasn't me, it was an alien with claws on its hand. So she's put in jail for 20 years. But then this other murder of a North, of a two North in this case, again, five-fingered, five-bladed finger blade hand through the heart kind of thing, and you're like, ah, okay, well, it couldn't have been her, so maybe this alien exists. Now, because there's this big military organization set up, it's like a bit like a NATO kind of thing, like a worldwide military organization which everyone contributes to, and that is like the anti Xanth kind of league. I don't know how to, I can't remember the exact term, but it's the like the human defense against alien force. And they say, ah, another dangerous alien. Let's investigate this. They knew about it 20 years ago, but they thought that Angela was just lying to them, even though they should have known better. Anyway, so they say, well, let's go off to St. Libra and see if we can find this alien here. And so that's what the two strands of the book are, in a way. You've got the police investigation going, well, who killed this guy? Where did it come from? Was it really an alien? And the other side where it's like, hey, let's go find this alien. And yeah, so that's it. So let's go. I'll just break it into two halves then and talk about this book in two halves, because even though these stories, you swap between them quite a lot, like I say, part of it is set in Newcastle with Sid. Now, what I actually really like about this is that instead of it being like Mindstar Rising and these other ones, which is very much, and also like put in the Void trilogy and in the Pandora's Star and Judas Unchained book, you've got the Paula Mayo, who was she's like a detective, and she's traveling around and she's roving around and she's going to this planet and over to that planet and over to this planet trying to find out what's going on, tracking people down. And that feels very much more like even though she's not a private detective, she is a police woman, but she's out on there by herself and doing her thing and using her superior intellect to get through it. Now, Sid Hurst, he also is our main policeman character in this book, but he's not like a private detective. He's not like the PI. It's nothing. There's nothing noirish about this at all. This is very, very procedural. And when I mean procedural, it's very procedural, which means that it's like, okay, so we're in Newcastle. We found a body. Where could the body have been dumped? Okay, it must have been dumped at this point or this point or this point or this point, because that's the only places where we don't have surveillance stuff from, you know, over the time when the body was killed on Friday night until it was, you know, well, you know, when they work out when the body was killed into when it was dumped, it had to have happened at that time. And there's a lot of, okay, let's look at all of this security footage and all of this security footage and all of this stuff from this stuff and all of this over here. And we're going to put it all into one big simulation stuff, and we're going to do a full zone simulation of the entire city of Newcastle for 2 days to track down this and to track down that car and to track down this and to track down that. Now, I understand if people would find this first few hundred pages of the book a bit, well, not so much boring, but it's very procedural. It's like, okay, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do this. The thing for me, though, is that I didn't find it bad at all, because I once lived in Newcastle. And I lived there for about a year and a half, and I worked in Gateshead, lived in Newcastle. So while I'm sure a lot of people would find this procedure quite mundane, for me it became really exciting. For example, Sid and the other guys, they go to the Market Street police station, and I know exactly where this is, and they walk to the Monument metro station and the metro and the Market Street metro station. I was like, yeah, I know those. They'd go down to the Granger Monument and through Granger Town. No, not the Granger Monument. I can't remember what the name of the monument is, but a monument in Granger Town. And like, I would do that every day. I would well, not that every day. Like when I first moved to Newcastle, I had a car, so I would drive down across the main, you know, the Tyne Bridge there, and across that way, and I'd see down where the body was found under the Millennium Bridge. And they talk about the Sage Centre on the Gateshead side, which is a big arts centre, which is mentioned quite a few times in that part, down by the riverside there, the quayside. And I'd see it every day driving to work and go past that. And I was driving past that at the time when the Sage was being built, and every day back. And then the rest of the time when I lived in Newcastle, I didn't have a car. So every day I'd get the bus down into town and I'd walk down the street, which Sid walks down and on his way to work in this book. And I'd go to the Monument Station and I'd get onto the metro and go out to Gateshead to work there. And so all the time when I was reading about Newcastle and about, okay, the taxi drove here and this car drove there and this criminal went over there, and when they dropped the body, they must have dropped it off here and they went there, and I was like, oh, maybe they'll mention my street, maybe I'll learn it. And my, not my street, I think my street was mentioned once, but I don't think it, maybe it was Stanhope Road, or I lived on Stanley Avenue, I think, and they, I think this is Stanhope Avenue or Stanhope Road or something. But then I lived in a place called Arthur's Hill, and that is mentioned in the book as well. A place where at one point Sid goes, I can't do anything, I'll take this walk down here. And he walks along a street, and they're looking for, you know, where a car was dumped. I think it was either where a car was dumped or anyway, something to do with a car. And I remember the road that he walks along. When I got rid of my car, it was broken into. It was broken anyway. The clutch was broken anyway. And then someone broke into it. So after the police came and checked it out, I was just like, okay, I'm getting rid of this car because the whole door had been like bent backwards out. And I wanted to get rid of it anyway. So I just took it down. And I realized that where I, like the scrap yard, the wrecking yard, where I dropped my car off for them to deal with, that was the same, that was the same road that's like the action in this book. So I was like, oh, this is really, you know, it, and so that's why it felt very personal for me. And again, in like, as I mentioned in The Prestige, I understand why other people aren't so interested in hearing all of the details about becoming a professional variety entertainer. But for me, those mundane details, not mundane for me. And the same as setting a book in a place where I've lived. And it's not just, I visited places in New York before, you know, visited New York and I've lived in Berlin and all these other kind of stuff. But this was very much like, okay, we're going to go to this street. And then that's, what street connects to this street? Well, this street connects to this street. And so all of these mundane details, which seem very procedural, really appealed to me. But of course, you're thinking, well, why is Newcastle suddenly really big? And you realize this is what Peter Hamilton has done in the Mindstar Rising books. So because of the rising sea levels, all of Norfolk and Suffolk are flooded, and all of the people who lived all across East Anglia all left, and they all just pitched up in the first place that they got to, which was Peterborough. And Cambridge flooding, all of the intelligent people left Cambridge and went across to Peterborough, and all the people who didn't want to be in London anymore and they wanted the cheaper land or whatever's going on, they would go to Peterborough. And so in Mindstar Rising, Peterborough, and that series of books, Peterborough is one of the main places of commerce and technology and industry and all that kind of stuff. And you think, well, Peterborough, why Peterborough? But then you just got to think, like, why anywhere? If things come together, if you do this, it's like, well, why New York? Like, was it New Amsterdam? New Amsterdam was sold to, or the whole of Manhattan Island was sold to the Dutch by, you know, for $15 or whatever it is, or, you know, $500 or however much New York was sold, Manhattan. And now it's so important because it's like the first big island, you know, and it's where everyone goes. It's just the place. But 200 years ago, maybe 200 years, maybe a bit more than that, it wouldn't have been the place. But if you can change geography by dropping something in there, you can't just say, oh, we're going to change geography by rising sea levels. But London is still going to be the best place. New York is going to be the best place. No, it's going to be somewhere that's, you know, 50 meters above the water or whatever. The rising water or rising sea levels didn't seem to be a problem in this book. You've got the idea that the climate has fucked up so much that now it's just, you know, the ice has just, it hasn't all melted, but it's kind of frozen and melted somewhere else. I'm not sure entirely sure well, but you know, by changing geography. And of course, I did notice another thing, a place where he sets Peter F. Hamilton, it's like a running joke of his. He has quite a few running jokes throughout his books. One place where action takes place in the Mindstar Rising is Rutland Water, and that's in one world. And then another book of his is the Misspent Youth book. And all of that series, that all starts off the rejuvenation technology, that all starts off in Rutland Water, and that's where the rich people live. And I was waiting for it in this book, and yet at one point they go, oh yeah, the kids went down to Rutland Water, and you're like, oh yeah, Rutland, that's where it is. So that's a good thing. But another thing that I did notice was that at one point, one character goes to Berlin, and it's only mentioned in like one paragraph. Berlin is only mentioned in one paragraph. And because I live in Berlin, I'm thinking, well, does Peter Hamilton, is he going to do the same amount of research that he did on Newcastle as he does in Berlin to do it? And actually what happens, he says, this character flew from this place and flew to Schönefeld Airport in Berlin and then up to Heathrow or wherever it was. And I was like, ah, Schönefeld Airport is actually one of the airports, one of the three airports that we had in Berlin. One of the airports closed down, and now we've got Tegel and Schönefeld. But we have a new airport that's already been built, and it was meant to be closed down last May, Schönefeld was, and then reopening it in the new airport. And I thought, well, there you go. Peter F. Amundsen got that one wrong. He made one mention of one fact, of one geographical feature in Berlin, and he got it totally wrong. But then I was thinking, well, maybe it's a joke, because the Berlin airport, the new Berlin airport, international airport, is being delayed, and it's not even going to be opening a year late. They don't even know when it's going to be opening. 2014 or something like that? It could be 2-3 years late, this new airport opening. So maybe he's just doing a joke about the utter fuck up that was the new Berlin airport, which is the new Berlin airport, and it still hasn't opened. So maybe that was just a joke. Anyway, I've only got 30 minutes into this review, and I haven't really even got to the second part of the story. So what we have here, and this is why I wanted to mention Prometheus before, because what Prometheus did totally, utterly wrong, was that it got together a group of characters, none of whom you liked, and all of them were just absolutely terrible at their jobs. The good people were terrible at their jobs, the scientists weren't scientists, they were the pseudo-scientists, the security guards, I'm not sure what they were doing, they were just terrible, the billionaire investors, like the worst ever investors I've ever seen, like, why didn't they pick someone? And I was actually convinced for a long time that, say, there was a conspiracy. Obviously, there was some kind of conspiracy, but there was some kind of conspiracy that you kind of expect from an aliens movie, that they're sending people in there and they're expecting them to get infested with the aliens because they want the aliens that are going to be inside them. You know, that's kind of like a common running theme throughout the movies. And I was thinking, well, that is a conspiracy. And then you realize, oh, there wasn't a conspiracy. Everybody was just really stupid. The captain, when he was, like, was just like utterly stupid, I was convinced he was doing what's the guy in the company guy in Alien 2, Aliens, the second Alien movie, Aliens, and he puts Ripley inside the medical facility and closes the door and releases the facehugger, and you think, oh, no, it's going to be him. And I thought that was what was going on. And it turns out, no, he was a good guy. The captain was a good guy. It wasn't anything like that. And you're just like, everybody is stupid. Everybody is really bad at their jobs. The reason why you don't mind Hicks and Hudson and Vasquez, like, wisecracking all the time is because when it comes down to it, those guys, the Marines, really know what they're doing. Hicks knows what they know what they're doing. They're the ones who survive. They're the ones who get through. And it's the company men who, they're fighting against, in a way. And what I really liked about this book that I'm reviewing now, Great North Road, is that when they go there, you realize that a lot of people are very, very competent at what they're doing. You know, you get the guys, I can't remember his name, was it the Ravi? No, Ravi was another one. Anyway, some helicopter pilot, and you're like, well, this guy knows what he's doing, and these other people are like, well, they know what they're doing as well. A lot of people are really clever here. But the leadership is this weird kind of Christian cult, like the Xanth is the devil and we're Christ's warriors and we're going to be fighting against them and doing this kind of stuff. So you realize, oh, and the politics is at the top as well. So you realize this whole thing is this weird religious cult slash politics slash, like fighting for oil, you know, all this kind of weird geopolitical situation going on. And the people who are going on this bug hunt, and it really is a bug hunt, you know, they might as well have just done the same scenes from Aliens. It's like, is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or is it going to be another bug hunt? Well, we know that there is a xenomorph involved. A xenomorph? Yeah, it's a bug hunt. That kind of thing. They're going to find a stabby alien terror kind of stuff, and they're sending in the Marines. And Angela is very much our Ripley character. She came up face to face with one of these aliens 20 years previously, and she says, no, there really is an alien on that planet. And nobody believed her. Nobody believed her. Nobody believed her. And now she is going back with the Marines to find the stabby, stabby alien. And of course, she's faced the alien before. She ends up having lots of skills which come in really handy, and leadership skills and all these other kind of skills. It really is. It's like, well, what can you do? Well, you know, I learned how to drive one of these loaders back on the other system. Oh, great. Well, you can do this stuff. And you're just like, okay, I understand that Peter Hamilton might like aliens, but sometimes it came a little bit too close. But it was, he realized all of the good points about aliens, that movie, and was putting in those good points, like the people who you actually like, the kick-ass guys that you don't mind, you know, that you actually like spending time with. You've got to understand, you've got to spend time with them. Prometheus just did all of that just so badly. There are many other parallels with aliens in Peter F. Hamilton's Great North Road, but I'm not going to go into those. Of course, they do have this other thing that happens, and you're like, wait a second, you don't march on Russia? No, what I'm trying to say. So there's this whole thing, and they're like, okay, so we'll set up a base here, and then we'll go on further, we'll set up a base there, and we'll go on further, and we'll have this other resupply mission, and we'll resupply this base, and then that base can resupply this base, and that base, and it's like, whoa, wait a second. Long supply chains, not a good idea. It only takes one thing to go wrong, and then you're stuck out there, cut off from everywhere else. And guess what? Yep. They get stuck out there, cut off from everything else. The way that this St. Libra is set up, there's a ring system. It's got a very extensive ring system, and all the time around the equator, and stuff is raining down onto this onto St. Libra, and also because of the rings, they can't set up any satellites, any useful satellites, any weather satellites doesn't really work. Communication satellites doesn't really work, which has never really been a problem. But St. Libra is big as well. It's like twice the diameter of Earth. So they're stuck thousands and thousands of miles away from everyone. Mild spoiler that they do get stuck, but it's pretty obvious that they're going to go. So all the way through the book, these two threads, these two sides of the story, one in Newcastle and one out on St. Libra, I kind of like say intention, one's pulling the one way and one's pulling the other. Sid is like, it's not an alien, it was a human. There's no evidence at all of any aliens here. And then across on the other side, they're like, oh, okay, well, maybe are we dying one by one because there's a saboteur? Are we dying one by one because there's accidents? Or are we dying one by one because of this? And in the end, I was just like, no, just nuke them from orbit, it's the only way to be sure. And you're like, oh, and of course, there's different ways, you know, different things going on, backwards and forwards. And you realize there's a lot more to it. There's a lot, the conspiracies go a lot further down. So moving on to some of the characters, Hamilton does characters very well, but then you're thinking, well, does he do them very well, or does he just spend a lot of time with them? Because he does spend a lot of time with these characters, you know, 2,500 pages in a big series. It means you get to know the characters really well. You're very comfortable with them, and that's why this is very comfortable reading. This whole story could have been told in 300 or 400 pages, but, he doesn't. He lets you really get into the characters, into their minds, to know their full story, and the full story of the world, and the full story of the everybody in it, and everything in it. But like I say, he does lap sometimes into more stereotyped situations, not always the characters, but the stereotyped situations. For example, this happens time and time again through his books. If a guy meets a girl who is kind of out of his league, and he's like, oh, I'll never be able to get this girl, he gets the girl, and you're like, oh, really? Like, so the guy always gets the super intelligent, fit, smart, good-looking girl who is just absolutely beautiful and outside of his league. Somehow he manages to get her. And I'm like, is there never like a woman who really likes the good guy? Like, she's kind of like a plain woman. Like, we like her because we know her well, but then there's like this totally hot, perfect, you know, hunky guy, and she's going to try her luck with him. And will she come away? Well, that kind of thing never really happens. So it's a little bit, I wouldn't say annoying, but like you start off as like, well, how come this guy got a really, really, really hot wife? And how come this guy got a really, really hot? And then, you know, and as I was reading through this book, I was like, oh, I realize. And there's, again, I don't want to give away too much, but the idea of a guy always getting the hot girl in this, there's a little bit more to it than just a stereotype. It is still stereotype, but Hamilton is kind of playing with this stereotype. Anyway, I mentioned Sid before. He's our main police detective guy. It's his first day. The story begins, and it's his first day back after being suspended. And because he's the one who like digs this body out of the Tyne, he thinks, and it's a two north. He's like, oh, it's a north. I'm going to be taken off this case right away. But he isn't. He's left on the case. And what makes Sid really interesting and really fun is that he has no secrets. He's just like, oh yeah, I was on probation. I was suspended because I used my secondary account, my dodgy account dealings there in this way. When I was taken off the job. I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have bunged this money to this other person. And so you're like, oh, so what's his big secret? And it turns out there is no big secret. He's just like a stand-up guy, a very intelligent cop. You know, everyone else is like, oh, you're going to go well. You're going to do better in the future. Yeah, you're going to get a promotion. No problem. And he's like, oh, but I'm not going to get a promotion if I fuck up this 2 North case. And they're like, no, it'll be great. We'll get through it. And lots of people are trying to help him out. He's obviously a nice guy. And it's actually really refreshing to have just a story of like a guy with 2 kids and a wife. And he lives in a house. And he's like, oh, can I afford to buy a new house? We really need it. Are we going to get a dog? And all these kind of very, like, say, almost mundane things, but you really like it because he's going to be wrapped up. You realize, of course, by the end of the story, he's going to be wrapped up in big, big events, and he pushes through to the other side. Our other main character, Angela, who is our, for better or worse, we might as well call her our Ripley character, who goes in with the Marines, who has previous experience with the alien. She is nothing but secrets. I'm not even going to say her second name because you realize, oh, she had a different name at one point. Oh, why is she doing? And throughout the book, all of the flashbacks in the book are really kind of laying out her backstory. Not all the time, but then even the times when you don't think it's actually her backstory, you realize later, it is her. So we get like the main thread, like I said before, is Newcastle and St. Libra. But all the time we're finding out about Angela's or Angie's, her backstory all the way through. And again, I don't really want to say much more about her, but there's interesting stuff about her, which isn't immediately obvious. There's interesting stuff, which is immediately obvious, but there's lots and lots of backstory going on there. Other characters, the supporting characters in Newcastle, I really enjoyed spending time with Sid, mainly because as an audiobook, he was like, even though he's the main character, he's also kind of the everyman as well. He's the outsider in Newcastle. He's from London, not Newcastle. And most of the other people he meets are from Newcastle. For example, his partner is Ian, and Ian, police partner, not wife, Ian is from Newcastle, man. So he's always like, away I, man. Ah, oh, crap on it, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm so glad that I didn't have to listen to Geordie accents all the way through, because when I lived in Newcastle, I had enough of Newcastle accents, of the Geordie accent. And I, even though I'm really bad at doing accents, I actually pick up accents pretty quickly. The reason why my accent now is quite neutral is that I live in Germany, and most of my exposure to English-speaking people is, you know, by the internet and other people in Berlin. So it's a big mix of Americans and British people and Irish people and Australians and all the kind of things. I don't actually live in a single culture with a single accent because I'm, you know, living in Berlin at the moment. But when I lived in Newcastle, I did actually pick up a little bit of a Newcastle accent once. I noticed I said something, I was like, oh, that was a Newcastle accent. And then I did everything I could from then on not to pick up any more Newcastle accent, because I was working with Newcastle people, Geordies all the time, and Macums from Sunderland and that area. So, I've got to be really careful about that, because there's something about like the regional accents in Britain, which, not all of them, but there's some of them which makes me just think, oh, you're not very clever. I know that's, again, me being totally utterly racist about this, but you think, okay, someone who uses a Newcastle accent, or like a Brummy accent, or a Liverpool accent, or a Manchester accent, like one of these like northern accents in a way, I don't know, there's something about it. And thankfully, didn't have to listen to all of that, because again, another one of the team, Eva, she's from Iceland, so she's got a weird mix as well, so you get a good mix of different accents there. And the narrator, let me just look down at the narrator's name. I'm sure I mentioned it here in my notes. Nope, I can't find it. Let me look here. Toby Longworth, really good job. Like I say, there's lots and lots of characters in this book, and he's got a lot of work to do with these different accents. And I'm actually quite pleased that he does so well, because a lot of the time, the only way that you can remember who is actually speaking at any one point is by the different accent. Anyway, so Eva and Ian are really good kind of sidekicks. Ian, mostly, he's a young guy, and he always gets the girl. And he could have been a really annoying character, except that he turns out he's actually really good at his job. And again, that's what you got to learn. It doesn't matter if someone is unlikable, you don't mind spending time with them if they're interesting. Even the bad guys, you can spend time with them if they're good at their job. And you get other police top brass and politics and the mayors and the commissioners and all that kind of stuff. On St. Libra, you get these other characters, like I said before, the helicopter pilot that I mentioned. He's set up quite early on in that story, and I'm like, oh, okay, this guy sounds awesome. He knows what he's going to be doing. Hopefully he's going to have a big hero moment later on. And he does. And when he does have his big hero moment, I really wasn't sure what was going to, like, what it was going to go down, but it actually turned out to be way cooler than I thought it would be. And there's other characters as well, more everyman kind of characters. I think it's Noah, one of the guys, Noah, and he realizes he's trying to leave the past behind, and he's stuck out on St. Libra. Or is he stuck there, or does he want to be there? What's he doing? Again, mysterious past going on there. How is he going to be connected to these other characters? Why are we spending time with him? And again, a very interesting guy. Not a major part of the book, but like you say, you realize, oh, he's good at what he does as well. Is he? Yes, he is. And even though he makes some stupid stuff, it's like, you, like in any situation, if you do something stupid, like don't do another stupid thing, or just don't even do the stupid thing, like they do in Prometheus all the time. And he does one stupid thing and he's like, oh no, I'm gonna do this, I've got to set this up, I can't do this, I'm just gonna call the police. It's like, why don't you just, like, on all these stories you go, oh, why don't you just call the police? And he's at one of those points like, oh shit, yeah, call the police, everyone call the police. And like, you realize that he was being stupid, and through the end of the book he becomes very much more responsible and plays a bigger part in his community just by like doing something stupid and realizing it, which is really great. Yeah, and you get the Norths. I guess the Norths. You get the A Norths, B Norths, and C Norths. One Norths, two Norths, and three Norths. They're kind of interchangeable in many ways, but in a very good way. But the funny thing is that all the B Norths, they're all called something beginning with B. So you get Bartram and Bailey and Blake and Barclay and Bruce and Benny and Bert and Billy and Bobby and... I've run out of B names. I can't think of anything more. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting way and very good way of talking about names, even though it gets a bit confusing. The confusingness is actually plays into the book, because one of these Norths is killed and you're like, well, which North was it? Well, they've all got the same DNA, so you can't tell them apart by DNA. So that becomes really tricky. Well, you can tell if it's a one North or a two North or a three North. We know this is the two North, but we kind of keep track of all the two Norths. Was it an A North or a B North or a C North? Well, I mean, how many A Norths are there? Well, we know there's this many A Norths. And how many B Norths are there? Well, there's this many. And how many C? Not quite sure how many C's. You know, all these different kind of things going on there. And that's why I like that the other names are good in this book too. At one point, this lawyer comes in and she is called Chantilly Sanders Watson. And her name is never shortened. So it's like, yes, and this is what Chantilly Sanders Watson said. And then Chantilly Sanders Watson said this. And then Chantilly Sanders Watson, and by using the full name of the lawyer each time, kind of gives it that aloof, like overly formal demeanor. And yes, it's a fun way to play with the names. And Christian Warriors, I can't remember their real names, but they took over, like they're the Anti-Xanth League and stuff. There's some good guys about that. I could talk more about all of these characters. I'll just skip on, actually, I think. So the writing is pretty solid. And that's what I like about Peter F. Hamilton, is that you're never really going to get anything clunky. It's all going to be well written. There's never going to be an action scene where you just go, oh, wait, what's happening? I'm all confused. Why is this person doing this? Like Prometheus is like, oh, why is this person doing that? Oh, I'm not really sure. Where are they standing? Which direction are they going? And like, all the action is really set out well. It's not quite as fun as, say, something like Ian M. Banks. But it is a little bit more like grounded in reality. If it's all joking all the time, like Ian M. Banks is, some things will seem a bit frivolous. Of course, he's using frivolous characters who are acting frivolously all the time, so the language can be that way. In this one, there's not too much of that. Good dialogue as well. I was trying to think of a phrase that I liked in the book, because as I was reading it, I was like, oh, that's really clever. Oh, that's really clever. Of course, I didn't make notes of it. Near the end of the book, someone says, oh, he bought a... You know, why do you bring a knife to a fist fight? And I'm like, isn't it bring a knife to a gunfight? Or is bringing a knife to a fist fight, is that actually a thing? I'm not entirely sure. But those little, like, turns of phrase which are a little bit off from how we know them now, sprinkled throughout the book, make it very interesting. So I have a note here. Lots of Geordie, lots of Newcastle speak. Oh, crap on it. Way, aye, man. Get that bairn out, you know, and all this different kind of stuff. Could be a little bit annoying for me. It kind of just went, oh, yeah, it's good. And like I say, Toby Longworth does a good job with all the different accents there. I think the pacing could have been better. I'm not saying that I didn't want a 1,000-page book or a 36-hour audiobook, because to be honest, if I'm laying in bed ill and I've got nothing else to do, you know, 36 hours of audiobook to get through is exactly what I want. But it did take a little bit to get going. A bit like... a bit like we said at June, it's like, yeah, after page 300, it really really starts kicking off. That's what happened here. A lot of it at the beginning, like I mentioned before, a lot of it is in Newcastle. Lots of procedural stuff. We're going to go there. And it's like, yeah, but we've got this exhibition to go into St. Libra. Yeah, but We haven't gone yet, have we? No. That's what we're going to do. We're going to spend some more time in Newcastle. And you're like, oh, okay, let's go. And now, how about, should we go over here? And it's like, no, because what are we going to do now? Yeah, we're going to spend time, a bit more time in Newcastle. And oh, just come on. You know, and even me who enjoyed going around Newcastle investigating, I understand why some people would want to go a little bit quicker, get moving a little bit quicker. But then about halfway, I wouldn't even say halfway through. I can't remember because I was listening to it as an audiobook. But let's say 300 pages in, they get to St. Libra, and then, like I say, things start kicking off. And there's a lot, there's a long slog to Moscow and back, and a lot of other stuff going on. With, you know, with the backstory and bits and pieces and the cutting of the action between, okay, this is happening in St. Libra, and now what's happening back in Newcastle? How is that going to play back in St. Libra? The crossing backwards and forwards is really good. I mean, I really, really enjoyed a lot of it. I don't want to spoil too much, but there's a lot of really interesting action. And in the same way, they're on a bug hunt. They're being hunted one by one. A lot of it is actually quite scary because they're in this jungle and they can't see very far. And you're like, so it's a bit like Predator in that way. Like they're going out there, there's the Marines, and they're being picked off one by one. I do think this is very much a homage to that kind of storytelling. I've talked about the narrator. Minor quibble with the narration, with the audiobook recording, is that sometimes I could hear the narrator turning pages of his book, and I don't normally hear that in audiobooks, but this time I did. I mean, it didn't affect my enjoyment of it anyway, but it suddenly, I hear something go, of a page turning, and I was like, oh, there goes another page. Yeah, so anyway, this is an Audible book, so I might as well just do a plug for Audible.com. If you're interested in setting up your own or starting your own trial of audiobooks from Audible, why not give it a go? Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and you can choose a free audiobook download, which will be yours forever. That's the way it works. 100,000 different audiobooks, and you can choose one to download, and it's yours for free. Take as long as you want to listen to it. But after 14 days, if you want to continue your subscription, you sign up for the script. Or is it 14 days, or is it 30 days? I can't remember. Either at 2 weeks or a month, you can continue your subscription. You get either one more credit per month or two more credits per month. This book, I think buying it from Audible, if you just bought it from Audible, not using credits, would be like $60 or $80 or something like that. And if you use your credits, if you're a Platinum member, credits work out to be sort of like, what, $15 each? If you're a normal one, they're like, you know, $17. I can't even remember what it is, but or maybe less than that. I can't remember what it was, but there's a way that you spend credits, and each book is either one credit, or a big book like this is two credits, and you pay a set you know, rate per month, and you know that you've always got credits left over to buy books. And this is a great way that sometimes you'll see a big book and you're like, well, it's just come out, it's still a hardcover back, it's not paperback yet, and you think, well, I'll wait for it to come out in paperback. The thing is, with Audible credits, every book is the same price. It's these Audible credits, every book is the same price. So as soon as the book comes out, as soon as it hits the shelves, it's not going to get less expensive over time. It's not going to be more expensive over time. And you can just download it and listen to it on any device. That's why I really enjoy Audible. It kind of makes choosing books not, even though sometimes maybe the audiobook will be a little bit more than the paper book, and sometimes it'll be a little bit less if it's like a new book that's come out. By having like a flat fee, you do save a lot of money by buying audiobooks like one by one. You certainly do. So I do suggest it. So if you're interested in starting up a trial, go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And in doing so, you help me out in my own with my own costs for this podcast, which aren't great. But like I say, this Audible sponsorship is just as much for you, to give you a good deal and to give you all listeners a free audiobook if you want it. So moving on then to this last part of the book, last part of this review, let me say. Yeah, normally I finish off with the themes. Now, one of the themes that I did actually really enjoy is the idea of procedural police work in the future. You realize that everybody lives in a surveillance society. Everybody, while walking down the street, is being observed at all times. But it's not like a 1984 thing where people are trying to break out of this. You really understand that, oh, the police are using this to be good, and some police are using it to be bad, and other people are like subverting it to be bad, and you realize that there's lots and lots of tricks to get around it, and the gangs get around it this way, and like the mafia get around it in another way, and the police themselves get around it in another way, and they're trying to track each other. But you realize that even if everybody is being watched all the time, that is a lot of data coming in. And if something happens right now and you're looking at it, you see it. But if it happens in the past and you're not quite sure when or where it happened, that's a lot of data. So just imagine a whole city's worth of data trying to sift through it and track things going through and just track this here and there. You get a lot of that. And I realize that now that like a full surveillance society is bad, of course, but you realize that it's good and it's bad, and it depends who's there. If Sid is doing it, it's good. If Ian is doing it, maybe it's not quite so good. So I really like the idea of that that kind of full surveillance thing. Yeah, and that's why I like about this novel as well. It's more grounded than some of Peter Hamilton's previous novels, which is like, oh, we need to sort this out. Well, let me get out my magic box. And when I get out my magic box, the magic box will be able to sort out all my problems for me. And then I can then just put my magic box back over here. And when I need it again, I'll get out my magic box. And you're like, well, what's really going on inside that magic box? When you call that person, what are they actually doing to give you that answer? And in this book, in Great North Road, you realize, oh, this is what they're doing to get that answer. Turns out, still a lot of work going on inside the magic box. Also, this book is, again, a bit more grounded in politics and economics and environmentalism, a little bit more than his previous books. Maybe not so much as, it's more rooted in those things in the same way as his earlier books like The Mindstar Rising and also Misspent Youth, you know, because you're based a lot more on Earth, you can spend a bit more time there. And even though there is expansion, it's at the early days of expansion rather than like, yeah, there's 1,000 planets, so if there's something goes wrong, well, we'll just go over here to this other planet and leave those problems behind. That's not really quite so much an option in this book. What else have we got here? Oh, yeah, and of course the normal, like, superpowered humans making things okay for the little people and making the little people look little. Even littler. That's what happens a lot in Peter Hamilton's books. You get that here as well. You get the super rich billionaires who jump in and help out the little people. And in doing so, they look great, but the little people are very little. And you get the super beautiful people who come into the lives of the little people and they brighten up the day and they're really cool and the little people look less bright. And then the super talented people who come in. But that's what I like about this book is that it's a little bit more, like I say, a bit more grounded. There are still the super billionaires there and the you get the Aussie in the other books and what's the Mindstar Rising ones? You get the young girl who takes over the grandfather's fortune and she's running the company. And you do get that a bit in this book, but it does kind of flip that on its head. So it's like one of the things is, okay, what if someone has all the money in the world and now they have no money? What are they going to do? And you're like, well, they could be able to do this. Oh, what about this guy who isn't super rich, he isn't super good looking, he isn't beautiful or anything like that, he's just got a talent. And what's he going to do? Well, he's going to solve crimes. And you know how he's going to solve crimes? Just by being good at his job. And you do get these, you do still get the super billionaires solving problems for other people, but this book does kind of avoid that. Mostly, I won't say it completely avoids that, but it's a little bit more balanced in terms of the real people compared to the supermen in the other books. Even though there are still supermen in here, the supermen can still get beat up. Anyway, don't think I've got much to say. Let's see if I can finish this off before an hour is up. I don't want to go too far. So in conclusion, I'm going to give this book 4.5 stars. However, at least 0.5 of those stars just there because I have a strong connection to Newcastle. Otherwise, it would probably be around about a 4-star book. But because this is based on my own personal enjoyment, my own subjective enjoyment of the book, I'm going to give it 4.5 stars. Again, if you don't know Newcastle, it's probably a solid 4-star book. If you're already interested in Peter F. Hamilton, I think if you read all of Peter F. Hamilton's books and you're not a big fan, or you've read a book and go, phew, that was a bit long, maybe this isn't the book for you. But if you're looking for an interesting book that you can take on holiday with you as an ebook or as an audiobook, which is going to last you like a 2-week holiday and you're still going to have time, you're going to still have some to read when you get home. I think it is one of his best standalone novels. I think it's a bit better than, certainly better than Misspent Youth. It's certainly better, I think, I'd say it's better than Fallen Dragon. It's a lot more mature than that book, I think. Even though that I have fun with that book, I think this has got a little bit more to it. But like I say, it is a greatest hits, it is a best of, or if you don't like Peter F. Hamilton, you could say it's a more of the same. I do like Peter F. Hamilton, so for me it's a greatest hits or a best of, not a, oh man, I wish he'd get some more ideas. So it's a bit like the Hobbit movie, I guess. So if you like Hobbiton, if you like the Middle Earth, it starts off slow, but you know that you're going to get where you're going to go, and it's going to end with a big action sequence, and that's what happens here. Yeah, that's it for this episode. Email me if you're 100%, if you're an SFBRP 100%, email me luke@juggler.net, and yeah, and tell me. Otherwise, the best thing to do is follow me on goodreads.com, or even better yet, become my friend on goodreads.com, and in doing that, I can see what you think of the book when you have finished it. For example, Mark Chitty rated it 4 stars, Jim Oriol rated it 3 stars, Tamahomi is still reading it, and Andre rated it 2 stars. And again, I read his review before. He says, "I appreciate Hamilton attempting to create a new universe, but his regular MO is getting a bit long in the tooth now. The sense of mystery isn't all that well maintained throughout the novel, and the big reveal at the end comes off as a bit of a stereotype." He also mentions that it manages to sneak in the clueless bimbo turned capable professional in the final pages. That seems like an in-joke. I think it is an in-joke, and I think it's, I thought it was a funny, way to finish off the book, with the clueless bimbo turned capable professional in the final page. In the end, the book was okay. That's what Andre Fodstad said about it. Like I say, yes, Hamilton's regular MO getting a bit long in the tooth, but if you enjoy it, it's a sweet tooth. What else? Yeah, follow me on Twitter as well if you want. I'm @LukeBurridge. Otherwise, that really is it from me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.